The Years of Lyndon Johnson, Means of Ascent, by Robert A. Caro, continued, Cassette 2, Side 2. The contrast between Johnson's activities and the grim battles being reported daily in the newspapers was not lost on Alice, however, and she grew disillusioned. Years later, jokingly suggesting in a letter to a mutual friend, Brown and Root lobbyist Frank C. Posh Oltorf, that they collaborate on a book on Johnson, she said, "I can write a very illuminating chapter on his military career in Los Angeles, with photographs, letters from voice teachers, and photographers who tried to teach him which was the best side of his face." Her sister says that she was disgusted, just disgusted with him after that trip, although she was still powerfully attracted to him sexually. Alice's closest friend, Welly Hopkins' wife, says simply, "Lyndon was the love of Alice's life." As for Johnson, his feelings for Alice no longer precluded seeing other women. "After Alice returned east, we had an interesting time up and down the West Coast," Connolly says. "In every city, the two young officers stayed at the best hotels, the Townhouse Hotel in Los Angeles, the Del Coronado in San Diego, the Empire in San Francisco. Sometimes the Navy paid, sometimes Alice's husband paid. Charles Marsh had arranged for Johnson to have the use of view bills, credits from hotels in payment for advertising, that hotel chains had given his various newspapers. The two young naval officers went on light-hearted shopping expeditions. In San Francisco, in a store owned by a Japanese named Matsumoto, who was about to be interned as an alien, we bought robes and blouses at just giveaway prices. He followed us out into the street just begging us to buy more," Connolly says. Connolly purchased a gray silk robe with blue piping that 40 years later was still one of his cherished possessions. During those 10 weeks, the movements of the Johnson squadron were cloaked in secrecy. There were strategic reasons for this, of course. Back in December, when Johnson had entered the service, the Houston Post, a friendly paper, had noted that by going to the West Coast, he had been placed in line for possible early action against the Japs. But, friendly though the Post was, it had been compelled to add, "Of course, if Mr. Johnson should be merely getting himself a safe, warm naval berth for use as a pre-campaign headquarters, and to cash in on his patriotism, the purpose of his entering the service would become obvious, and the voters would be certain to react accordingly." The Post, and voters in his own congressional district in Texas, might not, should they learn the nature and location of his activities as December passed into January, and January into February, March, and April, view Sun Valley, Idaho, as the front line for action against the Japs. They might even view his job as a safe, warm naval berth. They might even react accordingly. Another strategic reason involved Charles Marsh, who had business interests on the West Coast and flew there while his wife was with Johnson. Wanting to visit Johnson, Marsh had his secretaries telephone Johnson's office in Washington to ascertain his whereabouts. But since Johnson's secretary, Mary Rather, was able to tell Marsh's secretaries that because of military secrecy she did not know where Johnson was, the danger of the publisher dropping in unexpectedly on his wife and the young man of whom he was fond was averted. The secrecy, however, extended also to the Navy. The movements of the two officers appeared to have been almost as much of a mystery to their superiors as to the voters. Connolly is careful to add to his description of the fun they had in California, "In spite of these little incidents, we were really working." Even so, their commanding officer appears to have encountered some difficulty in keeping track of their movements. On February 15th, more than 2 weeks after Johnson had been dispatched to the coast, Professor Barker was contacted, not by Johnson, but by one of Johnson's secretaries in Washington, O.J. Weber, who said he would be forwarding some reports from his boss. "Where is that man?" Barker asked Weber. "Tell him to let me know where he's going to be so I can send him reports, orders, etc., from time to time, or we'll get in a jam." When Weber provided Barker with an address at which Johnson could be reached, Barker wrote the lieutenant commander, "I'm very glad to know your whereabouts, as we have had trouble getting any address to which to send mail. Please keep us advised." Johnson thereupon wrote Barker that "our messages and letters are evidently crossing each other." But the difficulties in communications, always, of course, a problem in a combat zone, continued. When on March 5th Johnson sent progress reports on various shipyards to his superior, Barker wrote back that he was glad to have them, but added, "I've been wondering how things were progressing in other assignments Johnson had been given before he left Washington." One thing at which Johnson was working was politics. Every day, not one but several letters from his congressional office would arrive at the Empire Hotel in San Francisco with reports on various district problems, ranging from appointments to the service academies and rural postmasterships to procuring for Austin businessmen priorities that would enable them to obtain scarce raw materials. Moreover, in Texarkana, where Brown and Root was building a military depot, heavy pressure from the Office of Price Administration was needed to reduce high rentals, which, Weber reported, is forcing Brown and Root to lose many men each week. Johnson would write instructions on the handling of each problem in the margins of the reports, or would reply by letter if his instructions were detailed. And he and Connolly were also wrestling with the larger political problem. In the first excitement of the outbreak of war and Johnson's going on active service, it had been assumed by everyone, including Johnson, that he would certainly not be running for the Senate nomination in the summer of 1942, and he had promised to support former Governor James V. Allred, a longtime ally, against Papio Daniel. When Roosevelt had given Allred his blessing, Allred had formally entered the race. But now, as the May 31st filing deadline drew closer, although everyone else concerned still felt that Johnson could not possibly run, Johnson was no longer so certain. The upcoming election would fill one Texas senatorial seat for 6 years. The other was held by Tom Connolly, re-elected just 2 years before and as immensely popular as ever. Johnson felt, John Connolly recalls, that he might not ever have another chance as good as this. Connolly and Wirtz told him, Connolly with the diffidence of a subordinate, Wirtz with the quiet certitude that made him the only man Johnson listened to, that running was not feasible, that, as Connolly recalls, war fever was extremely high at this time, patriotism was high, and it would have indicated he was more interested in his political future than the war. But Johnson appears to have been unwilling to let even a war defer his ambition. He kept trying to find an excuse to escape from his promise to Allred and to run. Although President Roosevelt made it clear that he wanted the Allred candidacy to go forward as agreed, so that there would be no split in the liberal vote, Johnson refused to drop the subject, and he and Connolly analyzed the situation from every angle, day after day. This went on for weeks, Connolly recalls. And Johnson began quietly maneuvering to be drafted for the nomination. He was also working diligently at obtaining promotion within the Navy. While he was not reporting often to his superior, Professor Barker, he was lobbying with Barker's boss, Undersecretary Forrestal, for a job in which the roles of superior and subordinate would be reversed. And he wrote to Forrestal's personal aide, Commander John Gingrich, "All over the place there is, in evidence, great need of positiveness, leadership, and direction. There is much that I should be doing that I am not. One does not function well without authority and responsibility. When and if you or the boss run into a problem that requires energy, determination, and a modicum of experience, give me the word. I need more work." Lady Bird says that the period from January to April of 1942 was a very frustrating time of high hopes which didn't come to fruition. That was a non-productive few months, and he didn't like it a bit. "A constant stream of letters was coming back to her," she says, "and after a while I could tell in his letters that there was an increasing frustration and feeling that he wasn't being useful. He wasn't getting the best out of his time. Lyndon had been used to running his own show in Congress, and in the NYA, too." In fact, her husband's hopes were higher than Lady Bird may have known. He apparently had in mind for himself a post in which he would no longer have to salute admirals, because he would be an admiral himself. At least an admiral. He apparently had in mind a job in which he would be not only an admiral, but in a position to exercise authority over other admirals. He wanted something big in Washington, really big, Tommy Corcoran was to recall. He had everyone working on it for him. Wirtz was working. A letter from Wirtz at the time is more specific, and also casts light on Johnson's later contentions that during these months his sole aim was to get into combat. On February 23, 1942, Johnson's most trusted advisor, to whom he had been talking frequently on the telephone, wrote him, "I can appreciate how you feel and how much you would like to have more power to get things done." Wirtz said he had therefore attempted, unsuccessfully, to see Roosevelt and had seen presidential aide Pa Watson, and had suggested that you be made admiral and given the same comparative job in the Navy that Knudsen has in the Army. William S. Knudsen had just been named a lieutenant general and placed in charge of all production for the Army, giving him authority, therefore, over hundreds of factories producing billions of dollars worth of war material. And over other generals working on production. Johnson was lobbying to be placed in a similar position over all Navy production and over the admirals responsible for it. But Knudsen was a famous production genius, an immigrant's son who had risen from the assembly line to the presidency of General Motors and had thereby been in administrative charge of one of the nation's greatest industrial enterprises. The fact that Lyndon Johnson, who had never directed any industrial enterprise, unless one counts the Texas NYA, whose main function was to provide campus jobs for high school and college students, wanted a comparable job, shows how lavish was his appraisal of his own abilities. Lobby though he might at politics and promotion, however, his lobbying was yielding him nothing. Writing to the White House on March 7th, he tendered assurances of his support for Allred, and then added a handwritten note, ostensibly to his friend, Roosevelt Secretary Grace Tully, that he knew she would show to the President. "Things are very dull here with me. How I yearn for activity and an assignment where I can be reasonably productive. I hope sometime you run across something that you think I can do well 24 hours per day." But the reply from Roosevelt himself contained a paragraph indicating that the President regarded the Allred nomination as all but settled. The only other line was, "I hope all goes well with you. My best wishes to you, as ever." And as March, the fourth month of war, drew to an end, time was running out for Lyndon Johnson. He had requested a transfer to Pearl Harbor, although what he planned to do there, without any service in or training for the Navy, is unclear. As it was evidently unclear to his superior, in a letter that month in which Barker expressed continued exasperation over the communications problem, "I have no address for you," Barker wrote, "I don't see how we can find an excuse to send you to Hawaii." Also unclear is the degree of enthusiasm with which Johnson was pursuing this request. If he was asking the White House for help in getting into active service, there exists no evidence of it in Roosevelt's papers, which contain requests from Johnson only for what Corcoran calls something big back in Washington. At least two of Johnson's older advisers, the two most aware of his true role in the war effort, now expressed, each in his own way, the feeling that Johnson was not trying hard enough to get into more active service. "Get your ass out of this country at once to where there is danger, and then get back as soon as you can to real work," the arrogant Charles Marsh wrote him. "If you can't sell the Navy on ordering you out, you are not as good as I think you are. It, the work in Washington, may be in manpower, it may be in running the congressional campaign, it may be in Congress, but for God's sake, get going and quit talking." Alvin Wirtz's advice was, as always, tendered in his calm, courteous manner, but while considerably more understated than Marsh's, it was, in essence, the same advice. After assuring Johnson that he was still trying to get him a post in Washington comparable to Knudsen's, Wirtz added that, "I am doubtful whether it would be altogether advisable for you to be called into the White House before summer and before you have some more active service." The wisdom of Wirtz's advice was becoming clearer every day. Johnson may have felt that an important enough Washington post, one he was moreover ordered to take by his commander-in-chief in the White House so that he would have no choice but to accept the assignment instead of service in a combat zone, would redeem his campaign pledge to the people of Texas. But no such post had been offered. What would the voters' reaction be if he left the Navy without ever having seen battle? The Houston Post, if Mr. Johnson should be merely getting himself a safe, warm naval berth, the voters would be certain to react accordingly. It was a friendly paper. What would the San Antonio Light say, or Colonel Petch, or the none-too-friendly Dallas News, should he return to Congress without ever having been in the trenches or on the deck of a battleship, without, in fact, ever having been anywhere near a combat zone? Johnson's secretaries were continually giving inquiring constituents the impression that, while the congressman was, so far as they knew, at last report on the Pacific coast, he was there only en route to a destination thousands of miles farther west, the war zone in the Pacific, and indeed might be there already for all they knew. But voters went on asking, out of solicitude, where the congressman was. And on March 13th, a minor state official and Pappy O'Daniel supporter, O.P. Lockhart, apparently having learned Johnson's true whereabouts, publicly suggested that if Johnson was going to spend the war on the West Coast, he might as well return to Washington, where at least he would be serving the district. Lockhart called on him either to resign from Congress or to return to it. Rushing out a reply, Wirt said that Lyndon Johnson is rendering patriotic and valuable service, but did not specify what it was. Marsh's managing editor, Charles E. Green, chimed in, writing that government censorship does not permit me to say what Lyndon Johnson is doing, but he's doing a job for his nation. How long, however, could the reality of the situation be concealed? Even O.J. Weber was forced to give his boss a warning. In a letter on March 16th, Weber wrote, "The matter of your being out of Washington is coming to a showdown, and you're going to get caught no matter which way you jump. Even if the president calls you back, there will be that element which will say, 'I told you he wouldn't get in any trenches with the boys.'" Since the movement to recall members on duty with the armed forces is gathering momentum every day, don't you think it is doubly important that you get on a boat and get to Pearl Harbor or some other place like that now, and as quick as you can? In another letter, Weber wrote, "We're going to have an answer to voters' inquiries. Any way you take it, the situation will be embarrassing." Other aides back in the district were similarly warning Johnson that his constituents' curiosity about his precise whereabouts and duties was rising. And Johnson's reply to one of these aides, James Blundell, contained a note of defensiveness. "I'm under orders from the Secretary of the Navy and the Commander-in-Chief. I don't give the orders, but I do take them. Today I am here, tomorrow I don't know where I will be, but it will be where they think I can do the most." Even more ominously, inquiries were becoming increasingly insistent from reporters on newspapers all over Texas, not out of suspicion, but simply out of eagerness to do articles about him. Newspapers had reprinted a cryptic message that Warren Magnuson had scribbled from somewhere in the Pacific. "Getting it, but am afloat." The congressman's carrier, part of a task force that had raided Wake Island and the Solomons, had just finished dodging torpedoes from a Japanese plane while Japanese bombs rained down. Other congressmen were now in service. 27 would eventually serve. A third member of the Naval Affairs Committee, Representative Melvin Moss of Minnesota, was with the Marines in the South Pacific, where he would win, among other medals, the Silver Star and the Purple Heart. Another Texan, Representative Eugene Worley, had become a lieutenant commander in the Navy and was in the South Pacific. Representative James Van Zandt of Pennsylvania, also a lieutenant commander, was in the North Atlantic on a destroyer escorting convoys through U-boat-infested seas. Having made during his last campaign a promise similar to Johnson's, to enlist in the event of war and serve in the front lines, Representative Frank C. Osmers of New Jersey had redeemed that pledge on the day after Congress had declared war. He had enlisted as a buck private and requested assignment to a combat unit, with which he would later participate in the Okinawa and Philippine invasions. Articles were appearing about these congressmen. Still unwilling to abandon his political ambitions, Johnson, as the months passed, had been unable to decide whether to file for the Senate seat or for re-election to the House. The filing deadline for both races was May 31st, and no matter which election he selected, the announcement of his filing would focus attention on his war service, attention which, under the present circumstances, might prove disastrous for either candidacy. If he wasn't going to get something big in Washington, he needed to be in a combat zone when he announced. And there might not be much time left, for Wirtz had let him know that the order recalling all congressmen to the House, an order whose issuance would require him either to resign from Congress or to return without ever having seen combat, was under active consideration at the White House. In desperation, he headed back to Washington with Connally on April 13th. In Washington, he made no secret of the pragmatism with which he viewed the war, as is revealed by a diary entry made by a new White House aide, Jonathan Daniels, after meeting Johnson for the first time. "Johnson," Daniels wrote, "wants for the sake of political future to get into danger zone, though realizes talents best suited for handling speakers and public relations." After telling Presidential Secretary Marvin McIntyre he would wait around Washington as long as necessary to meet with Roosevelt, Johnson was finally given an appointment on Sunday, April 26th. Judging from later communications, during this meeting he again sounded out Roosevelt about the Senate race, and the president again declined, this time firmly, to assist him. After a nudge from Forrestal, however, Roosevelt did assist him with his other problem. The president had decided to send a three-man survey team to report on the war effort in the Southwest Pacific. Two lieutenant colonels, one representing air forces, the other ground forces, from the War Department general staff, had already been selected. When Forrestal suggested Johnson as the Navy's representative on the survey team, Roosevelt agreed. On April 29th, he was ordered to Australia. On May 1st, still unwilling to foreclose a senatorial race, Lyndon Johnson signed two applications, one filing him for that race, the other for re-election to his congressional seat, and told Connally, who would be remaining in Washington, to consult with Wirtz and make a final decision on which seat to file him for. Then, with Mary Rather and O.J. Weber acting as witnesses, he wrote out a will in longhand, leaving all his possessions to his wife, sealed the will in an envelope, and left for San Francisco. Another envelope was sealed at this time. It was a large manila envelope, on which had been written, "To be opened only by JBC or LBJ. Inside is a leather carrying case containing four photographs, four of the pictures taken by Arnold Genthe of the most beautiful woman he had ever seen. Where Johnson placed the envelope at this time is unknown. It would later be kept in one of the locked filing cabinets in the office of his assistant Walter Jenkins, in which Johnson's most secret papers were stored. On May 7, 1942, 5 months after Pearl Harbor, Lyndon Johnson boarded a huge PB-2Y Coronado flying boat for the long flight to Honolulu. On his way across the Pacific to Palmyra, the Fiji Islands, New Caledonia, Australia, and the war, he had brought with him at least one political accoutrement, scores of copies of his formal portrait, and waiting for him in Noumea, capital of New Caledonia, was a brief reminder of politics, a telegram from the White House. Roosevelt apparently was concerned that Johnson might try to circumvent his strictures against a Senate race, and the telegram warned him off. It was signed by Presidential Secretary McIntyre, who officially spoke only in the names of Rayburn and himself. But Johnson knew whom McIntyre was actually speaking for. "Much talk drafting you Senate race. Sam and I think you should wire someone Texas you would not consider." And when Johnson arrived in Melbourne, Australia, there was another reminder. Charles March had been urging him to run for the Senate, but Johnson knew it was not Charles who had the brilliant political mind at Longley. He had asked Alice for her advice, and for a report on their reaction to the suggestion that he be drafted for the race, and on May 31st he received it on the other side of the world. "Charles believes you should file for Senate. Polls show you leading. No one else shares his opinion enthusiastically. If possible, telephone. Love, Alice Marsh." Whether Lyndon telephoned Alice is not known, but he got through on the telephone to John Connally. Calls from the South Pacific were limited in duration. "It had to be very short," Connally recalls. He just asked, "What did you file me for?" "I filed you for re-election." "That's fine." Those were the last reminders of politics. Then Lyndon Johnson headed into a war zone. Chapter 3. In the Pacific. In Melbourne, Lieutenant Commander Johnson and his fellow observers, Lieutenant Colonels Samuel Anderson and Francis R. Stevens, met General Douglas MacArthur, who paced back and forth in front of the maps on his wall as he gave the survey team from Washington an overview of the war in one of his famous tours d'horizon. The general's staff had arranged an itinerary for them. First, they would inspect major industrial and training sites in the southeastern Australian countryside near Melbourne. Then they would head more than 1,000 miles north to the bases from which air raids were being flown against Japanese installations in the conquered portion of New Guinea. Recognizing the importance of a congressman close to the president, the politically astute MacArthur had detailed a Blue Ribbon escort team, headed by a brigadier general, William F. Marquardt, to accompany the observers. The tour was conducted in the shadow of a war that was going badly. While the big Coronado had been crossing the Pacific, the Japanese had been capturing island after island. It was during Johnson's stopover in Hawaii that the first rumors of a great naval battle in the Coral Sea had begun trickling in. By the time he landed in Noumea, the rumors had become reports of defeat and of the loss of yet another aircraft carrier, the Lexington. With the Japanese now not only on New Guinea, but on New Britain and Portuguese Timor, Australia itself was filled with fears of impending invasion and of impending abandonment by its battered American ally. The lack of equipment was borne home to the three observers when they learned that the plane assigned by MacArthur as their transportation, an early model B-17 Flying Fortress named the Swoos, had been grounded by lack of spare parts. After several days touring the Melbourne area, they were flown north on an ancient Australian airliner, first to Sydney, then to Brisbane, and finally to Townsville, in northern Queensland, for a visit to Garbutt Field, headquarters of the 22nd Bomb Group. At a final briefing just before they left for Garbutt, they were told that a battle was shaping up at that moment, that a plane place called Midway. When Lyndon Johnson arrived at Garbutt Field on June 6th, he found himself in a landscape almost as flat and barren as a desert. The trees were small and stunted, the undergrowth sparse. Amid the trees stood tents, old and frayed, and planes, 12 Martin B-26 Marauders of the 22nd Bomb Group, twin-engined medium bombers much smaller than the four-engine flying fortresses he had seen near Melbourne. Not one of the Marauders was unscarred. The three observers walked among them, looking at the blackened marks left by fires, at the small, neat bullet holes, at the gaping punctures caused by shell fire from Japanese guns, at the jagged, gleaming shards of metal that protruded from them. One Marauder, which had evidently been forced to come in with its landing gear retracted, lay tilted on its side, the tip of one wing on the ground, the propeller on that wing bent and blackened by fire. The other wing pointed to the sky. The engine on that wing, jolted loose by the crash, hung down. Around the planes scurried mechanics, frantically trying, with almost no spare parts available, to get them ready again for combat, hammering, welding, threading belts of fresh ammunition into machine guns. Other members of the ground crews were hoisting bombs, slim 100-pounders, big 500-pounders, into open bomb bay doors. Watching them were crew members. Exhaustion and tension showed on their faces. Their uniforms were ripped and tattered. Some, because their uniforms had worn out and there were no new ones available, had donned Australian shorts, bush hats, and cowboy boots. Some wore fresh bandages stained with blood. Lyndon Johnson may have tried, and for 6 months had succeeded, to avoid being in a combat zone. He may have arrived in one finally only for what Jonathan Daniels had called the sake of political future. But whatever the reason, Lyndon Johnson was in a combat zone now. If one characteristic of Lyndon Johnson was a boundless ambition, another was a willingness on behalf of that ambition to make efforts that were also without bounds. As an NYA director to whom hours made no difference, days made no difference, nights made no difference, as an unknown 28-year-old running his first seemingly hopeless campaign for Congress against seven older, better-known opponents, a race in which he drove himself so ruthlessly that a fellow politician, a man who worked terribly hard himself, said, "I never knew a man could work that hard." At every stage in his adult life, as congressman's secretary, congressman, senatorial candidate, he had displayed a willingness to push to their very edge, and beyond the edge, the limits not only of politics, but of himself. In every crisis in his life, he had worked until the weight dropped off his body and his eyes sunk into his head, and his face grew gaunt and cavernous, and he trembled with fatigue, and the rashes on his hands grew raw and angry. And whenever at the end of one more in a very long line of very long days, he realized that there was still one more task that should be done, he would turn without a word hinting at fatigue to do it perfectly. His career had been a story of manipulation, deceit, and ruthlessness, but it had also been a story of an intense physical and spiritual striving that was utterly unsparing. He would sacrifice himself to his ambition as ruthlessly as he sacrificed others. If you did everything, you'll win. To Lyndon Johnson, everything meant literally that, absolutely anything that was necessary. If some particular effort might help, that effort would be made, no matter how difficult making it might be. It would be made even if the effort required was the one that was, of all efforts, perhaps the most difficult for him to make. One prominent aspect of Lyndon Johnson's makeup, particularly notable because of the rough-and-tumble world in which he had been raised, was his attitude toward physical danger, real or imagined. To Johnson City boys, wrestling and fistfights were normal parts of growing up. Lyndon Johnson had displayed a conspicuous hesitancy and timidity at participating in these activities, or at riding an unruly horse or diving from a not-very-high bank into the Pernalis River, at any of the routine roughhousing of youth. And at college, if a fellow student, antagonized by him, approached him to fight, Johnson would immediately, without a single gesture of resistance, fall back on a bed and kick his feet in the air with a frantic windmilling motion to keep his foe away, while yelling, "If you hit me, I'll kick you! If you hit me, I'll kick you!" A scene which astonished other students, one of whom says, "Every kid in the state of Texas had fights then, but he wouldn't fight. He was an absolute physical coward." Whether or not this view, widespread among his fellow students, is correct, certainly Lyndon Johnson had never been casual about his physical well-being. On the contrary, he had always been unusually anxious to avoid even the slightest exposure to violence, danger, or risk. Never in any physical encounter had he conspicuously displayed courage. But if courage was needed now, it would be there. Lyndon Johnson was in a combat zone now, but he was in it only as an observer, not as a combatant. Yet recall by the president was imminent. He was never going to be in the trenches or on a battleship. This trip as an observer was to be his only direct participation in the war. And if he was never going to be a combatant, if the closest he could get to fulfilling his campaign promise, the only means now left to him of protecting his political future, was to see combat, then he was going to see it. On the night of his arrival at Garbutt Field, and on the next day, he, Anderson, and Stevens talked to the airmen of the 22nd Bomb Group, hearing about the missions they had been flying. The missions were mostly against the Japanese air base at Lae, on the northeast coast of New Guinea, and Lae was a tough mission. As Martin Kaden and Edward Himoff report in their 1964 book, The Mission, the best available account of Johnson's experiences in the Pacific, just getting to the target was tough. Since at 900 miles from Garbutt Field, Lae was outside the range of a B-26, the Marauders flew first to Seven Mile Strip, a primitive little American base hacked out of the New Guinea jungle on the south side of the Owen Stanley Range that towered up to 10,000 feet between it and Lae. The flight from Garbutt Field to 7 Mile, as it was called, was over the ocean. The men knew what was in that ocean. As one said, so many sharks that we could fly low and actually see their fins and bodies cutting through the water. Occasionally, for sport, the machine gunners fired at the fins. Then the water would turn red as other sharks tore apart those that had been killed or wounded. Just a week before, a badly hit B-26, returning from Lae, had fallen into the ocean. A Japanese pilot was later to write that he had seen 30 or 40 sharks swarming around the crew members as they scrambled frantically to get into a life raft. Suddenly, one of them thrust his hand high above his head and disappeared. The others were beating frantically at the water. Then the second man disappeared. I circled lower and nearly gagged as I saw the flash of teeth which closed on the arm of the third man. The lone survivor, a big bald-headed man, was clinging to the raft with one hand and swinging wildly with a knife in the other. Then he, too, was gone. After refueling at 7 Mile, the Marauders took off for Lae, from a runway surrounded by mountains and jungle that was too short, that ran up and down a hill, and it was pocked with bomb craters so hastily filled with dirt and stones that sometimes the wheels of the heavily loaded planes would sink into one. Just taking off from 7 Mile, the pilots told the three observers, could be pretty hairy. And almost as soon as they had taken off, they were over the Owen Stanley. Since a B-26 carried no oxygen equipment, the pilots sometimes attempted to fly through the passes in the rugged range, often during turbulent tropical storms. There were no facilities for forecasting weather. Before swinging out over the ocean again, the Solomon Sea it was called, off New Guinea, for the best bombing approach to Lae. Anti-aircraft fire over the target was heavy. The young men standing talking with Lyndon Johnson had flown through it so many times that they had given nicknames to various gunners. The most dangerous, they told him, was the one whose bursts followed so hard on one another that they had named him Rapid Robert. And then there were the Zeros, which would roar up to meet them or swoop down on them out of the sun. Johnson had heard reports that the Japanese fighter planes were less maneuverable than American planes. The American pilots corrected him. The Japanese planes were more maneuverable, they said. And, they told Johnson, the Japanese pilots were good. The three observers, the two lieutenant colonels and the congressman in khakis, stood listening as they were told about the bombers that had been shot down and about the planes that, battered with one engine gone, had struggled home over the ocean and the sharks. The young airmen standing there at Garbutt Field that day, in their bush hats and shorts, had, Anderson was to recall, a jaunty air. But as Lyndon Johnson talked to them, he was talking with men who were so familiar with death that they had evaluated its relative forms. One pilot described a recent crash in which a B-26, failing to clear the trees, had plowed into them and exploded in a great fireball. When the three observers expressed horror, the pilots told them that they didn't understand. After a crash, an explosion was a blessing, since the men in it died instantly. The alternative was burning to death in the wreckage. But the airmen's matter-of-factness could not conceal the odds against them. 2 weeks before, 6 B-25s from another squadron had raided Lae. 5 of the 6 had been shot down. Although the exact percentage of American bombers lost on raids against Lai in 1942 is unknown, one estimate is that on a typical raid, between 15% and 25% of the planes did not return. The men with whom Lyndon Johnson stood talking among the battered planes of the 22nd Bomb Group were men who were face to face with death every time they took off on a mission. The following morning, their escort, Brigadier General Marquette, told the three observers that the 22nd Bomb Group's next mission against Lai would take place in 2 days on June 9th. Arrangements had, of course, been made for Anderson, as the Air Force observer, to fly on the mission, Marquette said, and now Stevens, Anderson's associate in Washington, said he was going also. There was no reason, Marquette made clear, for Commander Johnson to go. He was an observer for the Navy, and the Navy had no connection with this mission. Commander Johnson said he was going, too. After an early dinner at Garbutt Field on June 8th, Johnson, Anderson, and Stevens went to bed. The 12 Marauders had already taken off for 7 miles trip, where they would refuel for the flight to Lai. The three observers were to be picked up at 2 a.m. by a B-17 that was bringing two generals and other high-ranking observers to 7 Mile to watch the Marauders take off. A message had been sent ahead to the Strip's commanding officer, Brigadier General Martin F. Scanlon, as Scanlon recalls it, that an important congressman would be arriving. The B-17 got to 7 Mile late so that the Marauders, loaded, fueled, and ready to go, had to wait on the runways for the plane load of officers to land. But from the moment Lyndon Johnson stepped off the B-17 onto that rough little airstrip in the jungle, wearing khaki pants and shirt, a bulky dark blue navy jacket without sleeves and his uniform cap, and with a broad smile, shook hands with General Scanlon, he put everyone at their ease. Affable, nice, doing a job and making very little fuss about it, was how Scanlon was to remember him. Introduced to Lieutenant Willis G. Bench, on whose B-26, the Wabash Cannonball, he had been assigned to fly, he shook hands and was led to his seat on the plane. Crouched over, there wasn't space enough in the Marauders for a man 6 feet 3 inches tall to stand erect, he climbed into a narrow compartment behind the cockpit. There was a further short delay before takeoff. During it, Johnson stepped off the Wabash Cannonball and walked away to urinate. Climbing back into the plane, he discovered that his seat had been taken by Colonel Stevens. Johnson was later to recall that he had told Stevens that he had been on the plane first, but Stevens, he said, just grinned and told him to find another plane. Shrugging, Johnson got off the Cannonball. He left behind his movie camera and film and walked over to another B-26, the Heckling Hare. Standing under the painted caricature on its fuselage of a rabbit dropping bombs from a flying carpet, he asked the Heckling Hare's pilot, Lieutenant Walter H. Greer, if he could ride on his plane. When Greer agreed, the tall man in the lieutenant commander's cap turned to the 6 other members of the bomber's crew and said he would like their permission, too. And when they gave it, he displayed during the several remaining minutes before takeoff an amazing talent for meeting and greeting, for striking up instant friendships and intimacy that had been astonishing people all his life. Sergeant Claude MacCready, the bombardier, was setting bomb fuses in the bomb bay, one of the last actions before takeoff, and Johnson started to ask him questions. "I was startled at the questions," MacCready was to say. "We've had the wheels that came poking around before, but it was more effect than anything else. You can tell at once if a man really is interested." Then Johnson approached the tail gunner, Corporal Harry Barron, and asked him his name. "We started the kibitz around," Barron said. "The moment you started talking to him, you liked the guy. Liked him so much, in fact, that it suddenly dawned on me that this guy was really going along to lie with us." Barron warned him of what was coming. "You're out of your goddamn mind," he said. Barron and MacCready, who was listening, both recalled the corporal saying, "This ain't no milk run, believe me. You don't need to come along and get shot up to find out about conditions here or the things we need. We'll tell you that." Johnson, Barron and MacCready were to recall, explained that he had come to the Pacific to find out for himself what conditions were, and that the only way a man could ever know what things were like was to go out and see them with his own eyes and to experience it for himself. And when Barron again told him just how rough it was up there, all he did was grin. He kidded with the crew until the Marauder's engines, which had been idling, began to thunder, and Greer shouted down to his crew to board the plane. Donning a parachute, the harness had been adjusted for a shorter man, and there was no time to change it, so Johnson couldn't stand erect, but once inside the plane he had to hunch over anyway. Johnson climbed into the cramped fuselage and sat down in a small cubicle on the right side of the plane just behind the cockpit. Across the narrow passageway on the left side of the plane was a small window. A clear plastic bubble, the navigator's dome, was above him. If he stood on a stool, he would be able to look out the dome across the top of the plane. Lyndon Johnson sat, seatbelt on, parachute and harness bending him forward, as the heckling hare jounced down the bumpy runway and then laboriously groaned its way into the air with its heavy bomb load. The plane kept climbing. The squadron had to get over the Owen Stanley range, and for a while at 14,000 feet the air was thin. But he had been warned that this would happen, and had been told that it wouldn't last long. The 12 B-26 is divided into three formations, each formation a staggered V shape of four bombers. The heckling hare was in the third position in the last V. They flew for about an hour. Then they were nearing the target. In front of them, the first two formations were settling into their bombing runs, and then suddenly Captain Greer alerted his gunners. There were zeros ahead, ahead and above them. And then, without warning, the heckling hare staggered, and all at once Johnson could feel the plane slow down and begin to lose altitude. The generator that controlled the right engine had failed. Immediately the plane began to drop behind the formation, and the heckling hare turned to head home. And then, in MacCready's words, all hell broke loose. A lone Zero was bearing in on them, charging across the sky. Bullets were smashing into the plane, and cannon shells were bursting against it like shotguns being fired right beside your ear. The plane began skidding across the sky, diving wildly, trying to climb, diving again, then swerving, weaving, as Greer frantically jerked it through the air. Somewhere in those first few moments, the pilot jettisoned the bombs to lighten the plane. "Here he comes!" someone screamed, and the Zero, which for a moment had overshot them because of Greer's maneuvering, was boring in again, and again the B-26 shuddered as it was hit. Its own guns were in action now, filling the plane with a steady rumble. It shuddered and shook from the recoil of the big machine guns in the tail and waist. The fuselage was filled with the roars and the explosions and the smell of powder. And all the time the plane lurched and screamed back and forth through the air as Greer worked the rudders side to side, for long moments without result. "We were getting hit all over the place," MacCready says. "You could feel the bullets banging into the airplane. And those cannon shells..." The Zero was suddenly gone, and Greer was heading for a cloud bank that could spell safety, when suddenly a wave of seven more Zeros was around them, and bullets and shells were smashing into the Marauder again, and again the plane was skidding and weaving wildly across the sky. And then MacCready, firing from the nose, had his machine gun jam, and Greer shouted at him to get back to one of the waste guns, and he started to crawl back along the narrow passageway, and as he did, he saw their passenger. Lyndon Johnson was standing stooped over so that he could see out that little window, and what he was seeing was three Zeros. One would fake a pass, and when the guns of the B-26 followed him, the other two would come screaming straight in, straight at the plane, straight, it seemed, at that window, straight at him, with the leading edges of their wings spitting bullets, until at the very last instant the Japanese pilots dropped and zoomed under the B-26. "It was the kind of sight that scared you out of your wits," MacCready was to say. Johnson was looking steadily out the window. He turned as MacCready crawled by and held up three fingers. He pointed out the window. "There are three out there to the left," he said calmly. And he smiled. MacCready took a look, one look. "I figured they were still laying off, but they were coming straight at us and firing. The guns and cannons were all firing at us." MacCready pushed past. As he did, Johnson grinned at him, cool as a cucumber. Things seemed to get worse. The sky was filled with flashing wings with red balls painted on them as the Marauder struggled for the clouds. Radio man Gunner Lillis Walker had to leave his waist gun to crawl forward to the radio and find out if 7 mile strip was clear for a landing. "It was rough. The Zeros stayed with us, working us over, like they were having target practice." And then as he crawled, "There was this passenger of ours." The passenger wasn't looking out the little window any longer. He had pulled out a stool and was standing on it and looking out the navigator's bubble on top of the plane. There was a better view from up there. "From up there," Walker was to say, "that's a sight to scare the living daylights out of you. A couple of Zeros were in front of us and coming in, firing everything they had, and you're looking right into the face of death when that happens." Lyndon Johnson, the physical coward who was afraid of a fistfight, was looking into that face. He was, Walker was to say, just as calm as if we were on a sightseeing tour. This book is continued on Cassette 3, Side 1.